Futuro.
This is one of the strangest things about the moment about La Brega that we're in right now, is that people are leaving the island because they can't make life work.
Uno, dos, tres.
Hey, what's up? Welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Joining us from New York City is Alana Casanova Burgess. She's a reporter and producer for WNYC's program. It's called On the Media. Hey, Alana.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. And joining us, oh my God, I wish I was there, Montreal, Canada, is Cristina del Mar Quiles, reporter for the Center for Investigative Journalism, El Centro de Periodismo Investigativo. Welcome, Cristina. Hello, Montreal.
Hello, thank you.
So today we're talking about Puerto Rico, and we're talking about La Brega, which, okay, once I found out, because, you know, I'm Mexican. So, like, once I was like, ¿qué es eso? And then when you figure out lo que es La Brega, you're like, okay, cool. So you're going to figure that out. We're going to talk about that because you guys are like, what is La Brega? Well, it's a new podcast series co-produced by WNYC Studios and, yes, our very own Futuro Studios. That's right. We're dropping yet another podcast. It's going to drop this Wednesday in both English and Spanish.
Yep.
Seriously. So be sure to subscribe.
Yeah.
Okay. La Brega.
Yeah.
This is really fabulous to be in this company because, Alana, not only did you host the podcast, but Cristina, you and my dear friend, yes, and my co-host, Julio Ricardo Varela, you both reported and produced your own episodes for this series. But I really just want to talk a little bit about the inspiration for the podcast. You call it a collection of narrative and investigative stories that illustrate a different piece of Puerto Rican history and experience in each of these different stories. And in the opener, Alana, you call La Brega an anthology of Puerto Rico because there are really so many things that make up this little island. I mean, Puerto Rico es complicado, you know, super, super complicado, as I say that as an outsider, right?
It's like a Facebook relationship, yes.
It's complicated. You know, the history of colonialism, economic issues and inequality, like an extraordinary art scene, the diaspora that has changed, you know, the United States mainland forever. And it goes on and on. So let's just listen to how you describe it.
There's an imbalance of power when you're bregando, whether it's against your boss or some larger injustice. It's an underdog's word. A brega implies a challenge we can't really solve, so you have to hustle to get around it. And in Puerto Rico, there are a lot of challenges that seem unsolvable. Puerto Ricans are constantly bregando with the jobs that don't pay enough, the electricity that comes and goes, their kids' schools that are closed, the broken traffic lights that never get fixed, the hospital that doesn't get built, the government's debts that aren't paid, the frustration over status, austerity, colonialism. And La Brega is a word that came to the States with the diaspora, who have had to find a way to deal with a new language, to navigate somehow being immigrants and citizens at the same time, to struggle with displacement and discrimination.
So the series looks at this notion of La Brega. You also talk about resilience, this concept that came to define Puerto Ricans, especially after Hurricane Maria devastated the island in 2017. So, Alana, when thinking about La Brega, what is the main takeaway that you have in terms of understanding this really complicated Puerto Rican experience?
What we really wanted to do was to bring the same kind of thoughtful storytelling and reporting that comes from produced audio journalism, but also recognize that there's so much talent, there's so many different people who can really add to an understanding of Puerto Rico. So I didn't want to just host this myself. So right away, Marlon Bishop from Futuro and I started thinking about, you know, how we could assemble some kind of Avengers squad, sort of the best
Avengers squad of journalists.
You said Avengers. I'm down.
Me too.
You know, coming together, right? So we know that Cristina del Mar Quiles, who's with us right now, she's been reporting on reconstruction for, you know, and I put that in comillas, right? Like in quotation marks, after Maria. And, you know, we have Luis Valentin on our team as well. I think nobody knows the debt crisis better than he does.
Yep.
And, you know, Yarimar Bonilla, who's a political anthropologist and a writer, she joined us. Chris Gregory Rivera, who's a photojournalist, who's been working on a project about Las Carpetas for like 6 years. He does an episode about that. So we wanted to really open up a space where a lot of the stories that inform the current context, but haven't really been told, where we could sort of make space for those stories to be told in both languages. And then thinking about, you know, this is an anthology, so what pulls all these stories together? There's a sense of the, you know, the individual brega and also the collective brega, right? Like when we're in La Brega, and so hard to translate, but it's like you're dealing with something, but you don't really, like, you can't solve a problem. It also depends on how you say it, right? If someone says, like, ¿cómo estás? You can say, like, ah, oh, aquí en La Brega, you know? Like, here, just dealing with it, I'm coping, you know, I'm making it work. And there's a hopefulness in that sometimes, right? Like,
yeah,
like you could just lie down in front of traffic if you weren't going to bregar anymore.
Not a good
brega. Right, so, like, La Brega is kind of like a hopeful... Like, I'm still here.
Yeah, like, I'm trying to make it work, yeah. You guys. Like, yeah. Come on. And I think especially in this last year,
yeah,
you know, when, like, non-Spanish speakers, like, non-Puerto Ricans have asked me, like, you know, how are you doing? I want to say, aquí en La Brega, you know, like, I haven't given up. I'm holding it together. But also sometimes you don't even want to say, like, how you're really doing, because it's just...
Yeah.
It's a lot. But, you know,
yeah,
like, being Puerto Rican is really great. So it's not like a one note kind of series.
And exacto.
Julio's piece particularly is really like a celebration. And thank you, Julio, for bringing that sense of joy to it.
I try.
He tries.
I try to bring joy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cristina, what about you? Okay. We know we're asking a big question in very little time, but, you know, ¿cómo tú defines eso? Lo que es La Brega,
La Brega.
Y la experiencia puertorriqueña.
Yes, I think it's like when you answer that you're not really good, but you're not bad. So it's just going with the flow, you know, whatever the day brings me, I'm just dealing with it. So I'm bregando.
Yeah.
Estoy bregando.
And sometimes I think, you know, you mentioned, Maria, resilience. And what we tried to do in the first episode is sort of question that, right? Like, we heard a lot about resilience, especially after Maria, and it's sort of a cringy word, because what you're saying often is congratulations on putting up with so much. It's like,
yeah,
do we want our infrastructure to be resilient, or do we want our people to be resilient? And obviously, like, the capacity for resilience is important, like, psychologically and from a mental health perspective and all of that. But I think that word has just been so overused in this context. And we sort of interrogate it a bit. You know, there are bregas that are failures. Like, sometimes you cannot, as an individual, cope with the circumstances
right.
in front of you. You just can't.
Yeah. And sometimes I think that's the whole thing about Puerto Rico, is that you've got these structural issues that just, like, pero Julito, por favor, dime pa' ti.
Yeah, what?
You know, ¿qué es? Like, what is the essence, this takeaway of your understanding of your Puerto Rican existence, the Puerto Rican existence?
Es la vida. It's life. It's existence. It's just... pushing through and, you know, making sure you get a medalla on the side and enjoy
it. That's a beer.
No, I'm just saying, like, it's this collective feeling of, this is life. I got it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, I can be creative. I can be responsible. I can be irresponsible. I'm just hustling. I mean, I don't know what else to say. And that's, I think it's part of what it is in a lot of ways, because we continue to, as Puerto Ricans, sort of rehash a lot of issues. And, you know, what we've done in the thick the last couple of years, Maria, because, you know, we talk about Mexico and then we focus on Puerto Rico, which I'm proud of as a journalist. I mean, it's still in the news. Puerto Rico is still in the news more than ever. And one of those issues is just some of the reporting that we've been doing about status and statehood. And, you know, feels like we've been going around in circles when it comes to talking about Puerto Rico's status. And you'll see that the series is going to do something very unique. And we're going to talk about that in a second. But I did want to take a moment for In the Thick listeners who might not be knowing what's going on. when it comes to Puerto Rico status, you know, it's something that's coming up all the time. I'm just tired of it. But just last week, Scoop Varela, I've been doing a lot of reporting to kind of get through this.
Scoopy.
Yes. But Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said he doesn't support a statehood bill for Puerto Rico during a community board meeting for his district in New York City. Let's listen.
I love Richie Torres. I love the governor, the borough president of the Bronx, Diaz Jr. But I don't agree with them. I'm not going to support their statehood bill. I agree. We straighten Puerto Rico out.
That was a Zoom reveal. Meanwhile, just a couple of days before that, the governor of Puerto Rico, Pedro Pierluisi, gave his support for statehood because he's a statehood advocate. He talked about the advantages in a very high-profile interview for Axios on HBO, which I also covered. So here's what he said.
Diversity is happening all over. Puerto Ricans will always be Puerto Ricans, will be Puerto Rican Americans. Bilingual is beautiful. Speaking more than one language is an asset for anybody.
And then the news that came out of that interview was that Pierluisi said that statehood bills in the House and in the Senate would be introduced by mid-March, which is, you know, next month. The other thing, Maria, that just happened this past week, and actually on Sunday, the Senate president of Puerto Rico, who is actually not a statehooder, he is a member of the Popular Democratic Party, which is the Commonwealth Party, basically said, like, with all this vote for statehood and the plebiscite, said, we're not going to do much.
Oh, God.
We're not a state, you know, we're going to play politics here, and just is going to stall whatever situation. So
Wow. It's
a little bit frustrating.
You know what, Julio, I'm a little bit older than you.
Okay.
Do you know what that means?
Yeah.
That I've been covering this story of Puerto Rico's status a decade earlier. So when you talk about like the circling and the confusion, it's like, por favor.
Yeah, it's...
I was down in the 1990s covering all of this. And it's like,
Yeah. Bueno,
okay. So when we think about the issue, and I got... I think I told you this, that when I worked for CNN, I actually said this. I said Puerto Rico and its colonial status, and they cut it out. Like, they freaked out. They were like, you can't call Puerto Rico a colony.
Yeah.
So one episode of your series, reported by political anthropologist and professor Yarimar Bonilla, gets into the history of the ELA, which means Estado Libre Asociado, Free Associated State. It was a territorial status that the island adopted in 1952, establishing it as this thing called a commonwealth.
Okay,
sure. But essentially, Puerto Rico is still a colony in terms of political power, in terms of its own sovereignty. So, Cristina, with so much division still on the mainland and on the island, ¿a dónde va esto? ¿Para dónde va esto? Where do you see this going?
Oh, my God. I really don't have an answer for that. I was raised with this issue and discussions in my family and in the school and everywhere. As you said, it's like a circular thing. So I really don't see a solution. I just know what the consequences of the status are. So yes, I think part of what we're doing is like telling some of the consequences that this status have for Puerto Ricans.
Yeah.
So like when you say that, can you just give us a list? Porque tú vives allá. Like the consequence of the status that we have now is?
Well, I think that it is impossible for us, like in the actual pandemic, for us to take measures like in the airport, for example, to prevent people from coming into the island and spread the virus. And we can't vote for the president of the United States, even when he is the person that takes the decisions over the island. And we can take many of the decisions in economic issues. So it's really difficult for the island to develop economically if most of the decisions are not taken there, are taken in somewhere else. Many times, most of the time, for people that don't know the context of living in Puerto Rico.
Yeah. And Alana, you've in the series, you called the issue of the status an existential crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like this conversation, even with all these plebiscite votes, you know, they don't seem to be doing anything. And this conversation we've been having a lot, especially in a lot of circles, is often told from a U.S. perspective. And it's, like we said, the same conversation for decades. So how did y'all in this podcast series break out of that cycle when trying to talk about the issue of Puerto Rico's status?
Well, I think even just changing the frame of where the conversation is taking place, right? So having Puerto Rican journalists talk about it and talk about it with people whose lives it affects, right? I mean, we often talk about this as a political issue. Like, what does Schumer want? Mm-hmm. You know, what do these politicians in Washington, D.C.? Is it possible? Is it not? But as you said, and as I say in the series, this is an existential crisis right now. You know, yes, the conversation has been taking place in much the same way for decades, but
right. There's
a real urgency to the problem now. And, you know, that came to light after Maria, came to light after the earthquakes, it's come to light with the fiscal crisis, with the pandemic. You know, I don't know how many more times it can come to light. Mm-hmm. But actually, there's a piece of tape. Maria, you mentioned how far back this goes for you as a journalist. We found some tape from 1967.
A majority of Puerto Rico's 2.5 million people still live in the country, in the mountains, and in small rural towns like this. Now, for the first time in history, they have the opportunity to vote on their own future.
Back in the late 60s, when NBC was reporting on the first plebiscite vote, they called out right away the irony of the spectacle.
Most Puerto Ricans, even those who favor a commonwealth, agree on one thing. This plebiscite is, at best, only a temporary solution. The United States is not legally bound by its results, and neither is Puerto Rico.
And, you know, when people talk about magical realism, it's like, okay,
yep. You
want to call it magical realism, but did you just hear that? So basically, you can go and vote as many times as you want about your future and your status, but in the end, you ain't got no say.
Right.
Right. And one of the things that I'm really proud of with that episode from Yarimar is that she... Actually, her own grandmother had a really radical political transformation. You know, she remembers when the ELA really worked in Puerto Rico. She remembers
right. How
much more prosperity there was, that people were able to have a house and a sense of future. And, you know, she's 93 now. And she voted in the most recent election for the independence candidate. And then when Yarimar went to interview her, she said, well, do you want independence? And she said, no, I don't want independence. I just think that candidate would do a really good job, like, governing
right. The
island, right? So, like, let's change the conversation from one that's only about status to one about,
yep. You
know, who's going to make sure that the garbage gets picked up mm-hmm. And that the potholes get fixed
mm-hmm. And
that the schools reopen and that maybe we can get some, you know, like, some better paying jobs. So just changing,
right. Like,
the way the conversation that has taken place is always around, like, the politics of status.
So the interesting thing about Puerto Rican politics, and one of the things that I love to say about Puerto Rico to just demystify again, is that Puerto Ricans have one of the highest voter participation rates
yeah. Of
the entire Western Hemisphere. Their turnout is extraordinary. Puerto Rico takes voting
yeah. Like
super seriously, like there's deep political engagement.
Yeah, but it's also changed a little bit, too.
It has. But, you know, you could also vote for, like, I think at one point, the PSP, the Puerto Rican Socialist Party, or SAT.
Mm-hmm.
There is a long tradition of political sophistication at the level of,
right. Yeah, there's
a Socialist Party on the island. But in terms of the status issue, you know, in terms of the U.S., it gets a little bit more messy because you've got this thing, which are these tax incentives, right?
Yeah.
Like Act 22.
Yep.
It's going to benefit rich Americans over Puerto Ricans on the island who are actually treated like second class citizens on the island on which they live. In the episode that you did on the ELA, Yarimar talks to someone who moved from Colorado to the island with her husband to get, quote, the best of both worlds.
For Cassie, Puerto Rico's a place that brings out her adventurous side.
In some ways, like, I think that's what's so cool to me about Puerto Rico is that it's this, like, transition land.
That phrase, transition land, stood out to me. A transition to or from where? Is transition land just a different way of describing purgatory? What feels like exclusion and second-class status for Puerto Ricans, to Cassie, means greater freedom.
Do you feel like you live in a foreign country?
In some ways, if Puerto Rico were just another state, that would, for me, would have very little appeal. We could go to Florida and, you know, go to the beach and have a tropical experience. But to me, what attracted me was that it was different. It was like, it was just enough U.S. that it would be more comfortable to move here.
Just enough U.S. Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
For some people, it's too much U.S. All right. Well, anyway, then there's people like Peter Schiff. He's a millionaire stockbroker who moved his business to the island a few years ago in order specifically to evade taxes. It's becoming more common. Just last week, the YouTuber Logan Paul announced that he was leaving L.A. and moving to Puerto Rico because he's tired of California's high taxes.
Yeah. Just go to Puerto Rican social media and see all the wonderful Logan Paul memes. Anyway. This all becomes even more dire when you consider, like you have both mentioned, that we're in a global pandemic, which has worsened Puerto Rico's already devastated healthcare system. While coronavirus deaths near 500,000 in the United States, Puerto Rico has had over 133,000 cases throughout this pandemic and nearly 2,000 deaths. And while the cases over the past 2 weeks have decreased slightly, the CDC still lists Puerto Rico at level 4, the highest risk of categories for the virus. Yet tourism is increasing despite this. And according to the travel analyst site OAG, the Orlando San Juan flight tops the list of busiest international travel routes in the world. You know, Christina, think about this, because when you see this rise in tourism, it's always been a history of tourism as the savior of Puerto Rico and people headed to Puerto Rico for their own self-interest. In the context of modern day colonialism, like, what are your thoughts about what's been going on specifically with these examples?
Well, yes, I think it's one of the examples we discussed earlier about how it's difficult or impossible for Puerto Ricans to implement specific strategies like in the airport to prevent the coronavirus from spreading, because we've seen during these past few months, like the lockdown measures and the toque de queda.
The curfews,
exactly, that were like really imposed on Puerto Ricans, but on the touristic areas, like it was another country, you know? And I think it's one of the ways that we can see the difference about how Puerto Ricans are treated on their own island, right?
Right. What about you, Alana?
Well, I was thinking also, I'm such a sucker for archival tape, but there's this other clip we found from 1975 from CBS.
60% of Puerto Rican families are living on incomes below the federal government's poverty level. 60% of Puerto Rico's inhabitants need food stamp help. Whatever the past virtues of the island's relations with the United States, today's troubles raise some basic questions about this system in the future. And some argue flatly, it no longer works.
Like, that could be said about this Logan Paul situation, you know? Like,
for YouTube.
Yeah, for YouTube. And I want to be clear, like Cassie, who we heard from in that clip, she knows that there are like Peter Schiffs out there.
Right.
She's not there for the tax incentive. But yeah, when we hear about all the displacement that's happening, you know, this is one of the strangest things about the moment about La Brega that we're in right now, is that people are leaving the island because they can't make life work.
Yeah.
And other people are like, hey.
Yeah, and other people are like, that's great.
Puerto Rico, it's a great place. I just got this spot and now I'm going to turn it into an Airbnb and I'm, you know, and I'm able to live cheaply and look, and I can speak English and it doesn't bother anybody. And it's just like,
yeah, it's surreal, right? It's just totally surreal.
Yeah. But I was going to say, talking about Logan Paul, my man, Christian Bob, just follow him on Twitter. He writes all these like reggaeton parodies, and he did one about Logan Paul. Anyone who loves the film The Warriors, you know, Warriors come out to play. She goes,
Taxi Vaders come out to play.
Querido Logan, we see you moving down here to PR. That's Puerto Rico for the uninitiated. Mere, no la ferre. We know you want to flee the IRS. Just please don't do it here because we ain't.
Christian Bob, follow him on Twitter. He's fun. Anyway, of course, all these issues are exacerbated by the devastation of Hurricane Maria more than 3 years ago. Earlier this month, the Biden administration finally announced they would release $1.3 billion in aid that was meant for Puerto Rico after the hurricane hit, while also freeing up restrictions on another $4.9 billion. 2021, people. Hurricane Maria happened in 2017. Christina, so you have been covering the reconstruction efforts in Puerto Rico, and your episode for the podcast series on Vieques, which is a small island off Puerto Rico's east coast, you get into this. So you look at how the Puerto Rican government tried to get relief from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, as they say in Puerto Rico, to rebuild the only hospital in Vieques, which was destroyed in the hurricane. Let's listen.
Omar Marrero,
who was the director of the Recovery, Reconstruction, and Resiliency Central Office, known as CORE 3, said that rebuilding this medical facility as a proper hospital would be the first project to benefit from Section 428. It would be an early project. And yes, as early as 2018, they actually reached an agreement to start building a new hospital for $22 million. But just 8 months later, FEMA started changing the initial cost estimates. Marrero explains that they changed the cost to $50 million and then to $70 million. He remembers saying to FEMA that $70 million for a hospital for 7,000 people was going to be a tremendous hospital. In other words, he was implying that maybe that was too much money for a hospital for Vieques. Then, one day, FEMA changed his mind and started talking about just repairing the facility instead of rebuilding an improved version. And what the Puerto Rican government originally feared about 428 came true. It was not easy to reach a working agreement with FEMA.
And 3 years later, the hospital's still not rebuilt, leaving over 9,000 residents without adequate access to medical care.
Wow.
We also know that along with the impact of the coronavirus pandemic, we're in a climate crisis, right, that threatens disaster constantly, and we're simply not prepared for it. Just look at Texas and the winter storm last week as the latest example. So, Cristina, can you talk more about the struggle of rebuilding in Puerto Rico based on your reporting and how this humanitarian and climate crisis is impacting the lives of the people who live there?
Yes, it has been a very long process and with changes all the time that has made it very difficult to start the permanent work, the things that need to be rebuilt. So the episode I'm contributing to La Brega is about those first negotiations when the government of Puerto Rico went to the White House and negotiated with FEMA and Trump's advisors to decide what was the process that was going to be implemented for Puerto Rico. And the thing is that FEMA and Trump's advisors were very emphatic that the government of Puerto Rico had to accept to implement Section 428 of the Stafford Act. And that is a very specific section in the Stafford Act that what says is that you can build everything better than before. But of course, it has a very long process, and it was going to be implemented that way for all the permanent work in Puerto Rico. It was a new way of implementing it because it had only been used before, like in very specific cases, like saying the lower Manhattan subway station after Hurricane Sandy. Mm-hmm. But they wanted to implement it in Puerto Rico in a very large scale to all the buildings and the parks and schools that needed to be rebuilt. And that made it very difficult to start agreements for having the money at first that would permit to start the work. So that's what has been going on during these 3 years. And most of the work that needs to be done haven't started yet.
Wow. Alana, when you start to think about it, Puerto Rico's not rebuilt?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that Mitripea, like one of the things that really gets me about that,
yeah,
that episode is we can see how these Trump officials were really pushing Section 428, right? There's even this detail that Cristina got about how it was originally scrawled by hand on a piece of paper. Like literally scrawled by hand on a piece of paper. This was the proposal, right? Like sign this quickly.
Damn.
And so that gives you a sense of like, wow, this is where the power lies. But then also it's complicated by the Puerto Rican officials also who fall down on the job. What they do is they have serious reservations about this system, right? About Section 428.
Yep.
But they grab it and they run with it. Cristina found amazing tape of former Governor Rosselló bragging, you know, like bragging in public at press conferences about how great Section 428 would be.
Yeah.
So it's like as a listener, I'm seeing, oh my gosh, like this process has been failed by every possible person who is involved in this.
Mm.
Thank you for that reporting. I want to talk about another really important issue that the island has been dealing with. And it's like one more thing, right? This is violence specifically against women and the trans community. Mm-hmm. According to the Gender Equality Observatory, 60 women were murdered in 2020, almost double from the year before. One of our all-stars, Andrea Gonzalez Ramirez, was on ITT last year, and she talked to us about the rise of domestic violence on the island after Hurricane Maria. Sadly, she predicted that we're going to see the same epidemic happening with the coronavirus pandemic.
There's a ton of abusers within the police force. I found that between 2015 and 2019, there were 449 police officers who were accused of domestic violence by their current or former partners. Out of all of those, just one person went to trial and was found guilty. So all these things were exacerbated after Hurricane Maria. Obviously, the island was in total crisis.
Right.
There was not access to healthcare, to employment, which obviously made the situation at home for a lot of victims even worse. And it was very difficult for people to get the help that they needed. But the coronavirus pandemic is something similar, right? And what we saw after Maria happened in September 20 of 2017. The number of intimate partner murders doubled in 2018. So this was like an ongoing long crisis. And a similar thing could happen with the coronavirus pandemic. Like, we're not going to see the impact of incidents and murders immediately because this is also set to be a long ongoing crisis.
And well, last month, Puerto Rican Governor Pierluisi issued an executive order declaring a state of emergency for 18 months in an effort to combat the increasing gender violence on the island, which is kind of extraordinary, but also performative.
Yeah.
Cristina, you've been covering gender violence and femicides in Puerto Rico. So what about this move to declare an emergency? Is this going to change anything, or really is it just performative and the corruption and underlying inequality, et cetera, is just going to make this an issue that doesn't go away anytime soon?
I think it's the right step in the right direction, because there has been a collective claim since 2018 for this to be done. Like, the Colectiva Feminista en Construcción in November 2018, they went in front of La Fortaleza and asked Governor Ricardo Rosselló to sign this executive order. It was an executive order that they had proposed with a lot of measures to be implemented in order to address this issue. So 2 years later, Governor Pierluisi decided to listen to this, and he created a committee that includes organizations and representation from university and from different departments and agencies from the government. And I think it's important because it recognizes that gender-based violence is an issue that the government needs to address and to find solutions to guarantee the life of all women. It is not a private issue. It's not individual. It's not only domestic. So it's like a statement that says that this problem is a problem that the government needs to address, and it's a step in that direction for the agencies to implement measures to address this issue.
Okay, so let's move on to our final segment, which we call Sin Pendejadas, or basically no bullshit.
Or basically no need to translate, because y'all understand.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to state the obvious here. I'm talking to three Puerto Rican journalists who are badass. You all cover Puerto Rico. You've worked on the series La Brega. And I know Latinos, we always get told, but you know, you're just too close to, you're a little bit too Puerto Rican-y, a little bit too Boricua-y to tell this story, you know, when it's like immigration, the economy, you know. And Julio, you've been told this, you're just too close to the story of Puerto Rico. So
yeah.
No bullshit.
Yeah.
Why did you feel the need to tell this story in this moment? And we're going to start with you, Alana.
You know, the episode that I did for this series is very personal to me, obviously. It's about Levittown, Toa Baja, which was built by the same company that built Levittown, the iconic suburb in New York. And there's another one in New Jersey and in other places. And it's a very particular place. My grandparents moved there when they left the Bronx and they went back to the island. And I've always been really curious about it. And I've never found a way to get this story landed anywhere, because it's like there's no reason for us to think about Levittown, you know, Toa Baja.
Right.
But when you look at Levittown, you see the story about the diaspora coming back from the States. You see the story of Operación Manos a la Obra, which is Operation Bootstrap, right? The remaking of the whole island. You see the boom and bust, right? It has one of the highest foreclosure rates on the island. So it's like, you know, I wanted to use Levittown and to use this episode as a way of really examining all these bigger things. And what I found in there is that there was this program to also encourage Puerto Ricans to leave the island.
Whoa.
And to go specifically to like New York and Chicago.
Yeah.
And learning that really stung, right? But it also made me feel so much more like connected to the rest of the diaspora, right? That like we got pushed out.
Yeah.
And for some people it was an individual choice and for others it wasn't. And, you know, we can't really tell. We can't like go back and tell for what the reality is for each person. But, you know, I don't know that anybody else could have done that story.
Yeah. And also, I think it's so important to bring heart into this.
Yeah.
Cristina, para ti, ¿por qué ahora? Why now?
Well, I've been reporting on this for 2 years now, but the second part of my episode, I didn't mention it earlier. It's about this young teenager that died in Vieques because she didn't have the access to proper healthcare, right? So I'm not Viequense, but I have a really sentimental relationship with Vieques, I think, because all the history that they have lived, and it's like a never-ending story for them. And also my father, he was a civil disobedient when people were claiming for the U.S. Navy to get out of Vieques. So, so I do have like special feelings for Vieques, and I think it's important to tell the story also outside of Puerto Rico, because Puerto Ricans, as we tell in, I think, in all the episodes, are not the only responsibles for what is happening. So I think it's important to keep telling the stories and to let people know what are happening in Vieques and in Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Julito.
You know, I'm going to put on two hats really quick. I'm going to put on my Futuro Studios hat for a second.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
And Alana can testify to this one. I remember when there were initial meetings about this, and it was so important to create platforms for journalists, academics, voices, artists to say like, yes, we will produce this. Like, this story is valid. So like Alana's story about Levittown, the Vieques story, the Carpetas, those are hard stories to pitch in the audio space.
And in mainstream journalism.
Exactly.
But it's like so important to tell these stories.
Exactly. Like, I just got a pitch rejected from a major outlet like a week ago.
God.
I was told that I write too much about Puerto Rico to cover. Like, I have too many
opinions.
Takes. Yeah. I have too many takes on Puerto Rico to write about Puerto Rico, essentially. So I think it was very important, and the vision with NYC Studios and Futuro Studios, like, it made a lot of sense. So that's my Futuro Studios answer. But a quick answer for me as a journalist, as someone who loves to cover sports and the intersectionality of sports and culture and identity, and if people have listened to Latino USA in the past, just Google the Bronx Judas, just to have the opportunity to talk about the 2004 Puerto Rican national basketball team in a way that I've always wanted to tell the story. And like Alana mentions Marlon Bishop, who is, you know, my brother in a lot of ways, you know, we're creative partners. And to have that moment to just do it with people that you love and trust and just in a very collaborative space as Puerto Ricans and be like, your story matters.
Dude, I'm excited.
It's awesome.
I'm excited. Thank you to all of you. Thank you to all of you for being Puerto Rican journalists, my colleagues in our profession, and keeping it real and playing a part, your part in American history and in journalism. Really appreciate it. La Brega, everybody, La Brega drops this Wednesday. So go subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Alana Casanova Burgess, reporter and producer for WNYC's On the Media and host of La Brega, and Cristina del Mar Quiles, reporter for the Center for Investigative Journalism, Centro de Periodismo Investigativo. Thank you so much for joining Julio and me on this episode of In the Thick.
Gracias.
Thank you so much.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Uno, dos, tres.
Remember, dear listener, to go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us. Also, you can remember to listen to In the Thick on Pandora, Spotify, wherever you choose to get your podcasts on. Check us out on the web at inthethick.org. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell your friends and family to listen.
Yes.
In the Thick is produced by Nicole Rothwell, Noor Saudi, and Harsh Nahata, with editorial support from Erica Dilde. Our audio engineering team is Stephanie Lebeau, Julia Caruso, Leah Shaw, Elisheba Itu, Rosana Caban, and Gabriela Baez. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Thanks to Raul Perez for recording me. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional Kept and CCK Records. We'll see you on our next episode, dear listener. Thank you so much for listening. Now you know lo que es la brega.
La brega, campeones. ¡Viva Puerto Rico! Hey, stay safe, y'all.
Bueno, voy a bregar. See ya.
Hold on a second. Ready? 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 Here we go. Together, Wendy, we can tell the baby would never go back. All right. All right. That was a jolt of energy.
Yeah, I got to get in my car now.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.